the CBDC, the Kiwi dollar, for it to be successful and to actually contest against the US dollar, it's going to have to move on the fastest, cheapest rails, which is going to be a Bitcoin layer two, whether that's Liquid or whether that's on the Lightning via Taro, which is another way of putting assets on Lightning. And by waiting until now, the central bank can actually act very quickly with the right technology.
Hello, I am Cody Allingham, and this is the Transformation of Value podcast. In this episode, I talk with James Vigiano about recent comments made by the Governor of the Reserve Bank of New Zealand. Not soon after we spoke, James shared a clip that went viral of the Governor talking frankly about the exorbitant privilege of money printing that the central banks and government have.
It's a great business to be in, central banking. Print money and people believe it. And it's a slightly different beast.
James and I talk about some of the game theory from the perspective of the Reserve Bank to defend the Kiwi dollar and their attempts to talk down inflation and shift the narrative even as the cost of living crisis continues. We talk about the opportunity for what New Zealand could look like on a Bitcoin standard and how that could interface with the legacy financial system. If you have any questions or would like to reach out, my emails are always open, hello@thetransformationofvalue.com. If you would like to support the show, please consider leaving a review or boosting some sats via your favorite podcasting 2.0 platform. Otherwise, on to the show. How are you, James?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing great, thanks.
That's good.
Yeah. I woke up this morning, someone sent me an article, which we're going to talk about today, I hope, around the Reserve Bank, the Governor of the Reserve Bank of New Zealand's comments around Bitcoin, which I thought was interesting. I was reading it in bed on my phone. It's not always the best way to start the day, but it gave me a little bit of a giddy sort of a moment seeing the words Bitcoin uttered in that context. Did you get a chance to read that article?
Yeah, I have. And I actually went and checked the Parliament website for the video recording, which hasn't been shared yet, or I couldn't find it.
Oh. It is on Vimeo. I saw someone had shared it on Twitter, so I'll link that through to you later.
Awesome.
I guess starting out, man, how have you been? What have you been working on lately?
Yeah, I've been good. I think when you messaged me about coming back for a chat, my initial response was, oh, I feel like I haven't made progress. But I think upon reflection, the reason I feel like that is because there is so much stuff happening in Bitcoin that it's a little bit overwhelming trying to keep up with it all.
Yeah, I know that feeling. Some days I've forgotten what it's like when price is pumping, stuff is getting launched, new things are happening, and it's like almost overwhelming, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you look back on where things have been for the last few years, we've kind of had a bit of a respite from that kind of adrenaline dump every day of just things going crazy. But I feel like the time of that peace and kind of tranquility is coming to an end, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, things are moving quite quickly now.
Yeah. What's your experience been with that sort of thing, though? Because, I mean, I guess going through different cycles, you sort of have the high and the low and the sort of the different way of feeling about it, I guess. But, like, how have you dealt with that in the past? How have you been able to keep a level head?
Probably by not keeping a level head. I think I usually FOMO in, and then, you know, it's so at the moment, I think the reason it's feeling a bit overwhelming is that it's not just Bitcoin and Bitcoin applications that are really taking off and going viral. It's that paradigm shift with Nostr, which I understand you went to an awesome conference in Asia about that.
Yeah.
So that's completely changed the way I use the web, and it's crazy.
Yeah, or not even just that, those two things, but I think there's just a whole lot of moving parts right now, but I'm seeing conversations in normal people world emerging that are getting really interesting. Obviously, we've got macroeconomic, global, geopolitical things that are unfolding. There's like quite a lot of things, and it's always hard to kind of look at them all in totality. You know, that's not how it works, right? You sort of just get to see little parts of it. But the the whole thing, I guess my take is that basically change is accelerating right now. There's always a state of change happening in the world, but it feels like we're accelerating into new kinds of change, and new changes happening every day. And that presents some really powerful asymmetric opportunities if you're willing to take a gamble on something, or you're willing to reason through a hypothesis and say, okay, I think this is going to happen. I'm going to allocate resources to exploring that. It can be a really good opportunity to make some of those changes actually work for you as an individual as well.
Yeah, I think the wisdom I might have learned from previous cycles is slow and steady wins the race. exactly what you said, the asymmetric opportunity. Well, that's asymmetric opportunities being there all year. Bitcoin went from 18,000 up to 50,000 today, US dollars. So, it's always there, and the best way to approach that particular asymmetric opportunity is the stay humble, stats, dollar cost average approach, in my mind. The risk right now, as things get exciting, is leveraging, borrowing money, and FOMOing into Bitcoin, because you have to be able to weather the long bear market, which, as we've just experienced, is long, and they always happen. So.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think I've had a lot to think about. And I think in particular, the last few months have just given me a lot of space to really consider what it is that I'm doing, and sort of some of my broader work in terms of what I'm doing just outside of Bitcoin, and kind of the way I live my life, I guess, these kinds of questions. And I think it's quite grounding to come back to that, because ultimately there is this revolution taking place, but you Well, for me, it's important to have things that are outside of that that can also be that are real, And so, I'm enjoying just working on my creative practice, working on relationship building with just, people around me, and just kind of being more rounded in that space. And that's exactly as you say, that sort of stay humble, stack sats, keep your head down and building, even though things might be popping off. Because just as quickly as they get exciting and interesting and frothy, they can also become there can be unexpected volatility, there can be pullbacks, whatever. And we've seen all of that happen before.
Yeah, it's like even things outside of Bitcoin go through excitement periods and then quiet periods. Like even things like the internet with Amazon fell 90% back in the early 2000s. So it's like people who are building in the Bitcoin space, they're experiencing a flurry of activity and excitement, which is cool. But if they're building something for the long term, they have to be prepared for some of that excitement to drop off for a little while. And now they're building a sustainable business that will grow with that. I think your point about you're focusing on things maybe outside of Bitcoin a little bit, like your personal career and wealth building. That's what's exciting me about Nostr so much. So I've been focusing on streaming. So I play Rust, and I've been streaming it through Nostr. And without any barrier to entry, I'm receiving zaps just for streaming. And I've been trying to stream on Twitch in the past, but to get to the level of affiliate and partner to be able to earn an income from your viewers is quite a challenge. But Nostr makes these content creation so much easier to monetize, so much more frictionless to monetize. And that would apply as well to your art.
No, it's I certainly I enjoy I think more so with the writing. I've sort of it's been interesting. As you know, I do a lot of photography, but I actually have been doing a lot more writing lately, and so primarily creative writing, a lot of fiction stuff, sort of way
Oh,
off
cool.
over here. But in terms of Bitcoin as well, I think there is obviously this conversation around ChatGPT and AI stuff, and I think that has its role, but there is still a space for powerful writing, kind of intellectual writing about what's happening right now, and kind of engaging with that, and being able to fall back on, the history of journalism, the history of nonfiction writing, in terms of how we explore what's happening and the kind of these narratives. And I think that's going to be the sort of thing that stands the test of time. And so there's what I would consider process writing, kind of like you get processed food, and it's just, blog articles and whatnot. But I think there's also a role for like the critical think pieces. And a great example of that is the bullish case for Bitcoin, which is, I think a Medium article originally. But that is a short piece that really, it kind of touches on new areas and new thought. And so that kind of writing is really important as we kind of try to work out what's going on. And I think complementing that is the podcast format, which is quite conversational as well, which is something you can't really do with a one-way article, to be able to find truth together as we kind of stand back and think, man, what's actually happening as things pop off.
Yeah. And I think like what NOS has really shown me in the last month basically is as Bitcoin's prices rallied, Bitcoiners are becoming more generous with their tipping, because you know these are stats they might have stacked humbly a year ago, and now they're going so much further when they spend them. And so I don't describe Bitcoin as a circular economy. I think it's part of a global economy. But you can see Bitcoiners recycling their Bitcoin with each other. The circulation is going up massively, which is interesting because just today, as you mentioned, New Zealand's central bank governor came out and made a statement: Bitcoin is not a unit of account, medium of exchange, blah blah blah. It's like, well, obviously he doesn't know about Sats. He's not using Noster, but.
I do want to dive into that article in a moment, but just coming back, so we're talking about Nostra. So you've relatively recently been exploring the streaming stuff, or you've been using Nostra for a while though, right?
Yeah, so I use Nostra under my gamer tag rather than my personal name, because that's like, I guess that's the fun thing about Nostra. You can have lots of identities. And what I've been using is ZapStream. And ZapStream is really cool because it allows you to stream, which is what it should do, just like Twitch or YouTube. But the audience, first of all, is Bitcoiners. They're the ones seeing it. They're viewing it from any client they want. They could be using Amethyst on their phone. They could be using my favorite web client right now is probably NoStrudel. Have you heard of NoStrudel?
No.
Oh, so good. So so NoStrudel, like the pastry. It basically provides a bird's eye view of all your interactions in Nostra. All the things that you can do in Nostra are all in one place. And it makes me realize that Nostra is a lot more than just another social media clone. It is so much more and bigger than that. So using NoStrudel has been really cool. That's helped me realize what the potential is of Nostra, the different types of posts you can create, the different types of data you can see. Did you know that you can see people DMing each other on Nostra?
Yeah,
that's funny.
You can see it, but you can't see the content. But you can see the engagement.
And you can also take someone's public identity, their NPUB, and you can view Nostra from their point of view. You can see what their feed looks like from the base of what they're following. You can see their likes. You can see their zaps they've earned. So that's really interesting. So I've been getting really into streaming and zapping people's sats on Nostra. Yeah, it's been great.
Yeah, I think just on the Nostra piece, I've, you know, as you mentioned, I went to the Nostra Asia conference last year and I've been following it. I use Primal quite a lot just on web. And I do think it's a bit of a sleeper. It's sort of gone through its hype phase, and I think now it's kind of going through the build phase. And the opportunity that I see is that it is this kind of uncensorable layer, this kind of tunnel that can be used. And so when things pop off politically, potentially, and we start seeing some real clampdowns on freedom of speech or the ability of people to do stuff online, I think having that Nostra channel available to just be able to communicate and kind of network, because I think point-to-point communication is always going to be possible with, you know, email or something. You know, you can spin those up, but the ability to build critical mass and kind of disseminate ideas really quickly through sort of the what you'd think of as social media, I can see that certainly being infringed. And as we come up into the US election, something like Twitter, you know, we don't know what's going to happen there, but there could be some real challenges around how that information flow gets controlled shaped or sort of sculpted to sort of, you know what I mean?
100%. Like Nostra right now is like such high signal. Well, you have to put in the work to curate the feed to get the high signal, but it is very high signal. One reason is because the people sharing content are incentivized to put in the effort because they want to earn some zaps, some sats. So it's a very high signal. And one of the reasons I like Nostrudel is that when you take that bird's eye view, it's not just about posting content. It's actually your portal to a bunch of web services. It completely changes the way I navigate the web. I guess I should explain for people unfamiliar with Nostr is that you have like your one identity, your one secret, your private key, and you can use that to access any of these different services and web clients. And it becomes very quick and handy when that private key is in a browser extension. So there's LB, there's ZBD, there's NOS2X. There's probably some others I'm missing for different browsers. But so you have your like password in this browser extension, and it also connects to your Lightning wallet. You can use a custodial Lightning wallet, or you can connect your own Lightning wallet to it. And now suddenly you're browsing a whole different kind of web. You're browsing a web where you don't ever have to create another account again. You never have to enter in an email address. You never have to hand over your date of birth, your address, just to sign up for a service. You have all these services available to you with one click, and it's so quick. Like you can run an empire on the internet much easier now, is what I'm trying to say. Like you can operate so many things across so many accounts, across so many different mediums. So that's really exciting me.
Yeah, no, I'm glad to hear that. I think there's a lot of opportunity there. I think I was thinking about it a little bit more last year than I am this year, but it's still, I mean, it's there in my mind. But the kind of the analogy I come back to is around physical space, right? So if we think of the internet as a kind of mapping onto the geopolitical world, we've got these kind of alliances and these technology companies and these things that have really carved up what we think of as the internet, in a way that can be problematic. Whereas Nostra is this kind of step change that can enable quite broad development or broad rollout of this uncensorable layer. And again, it's not just point to point because we've got VPNs, we've got temporary email addresses and things like that, which allow you as an individual to do something privately and uncensorably. But the ability to roll that out at a kind of a network layer is the innovation that I'm feeling, and I think we will see more of that emerge. I certainly had some great conversations at Nostra Asia around things like GitHub on Nostra, or X on or not X as in Twitter, but XYZ, name your centralized service on Nostra, and I think that stuff just takes time to build out, and obviously there's still a lot of development to be done. I think there's a few key pieces of protocol that are still being worked on at the moment in terms of key rotations and things like that. But as that matures, which it no doubt will, then I think we'll see this kind of this opt-out ability of clear net internet, where it's like, yeah, we could just go and do our own thing over here, and it's unstoppable. And I think that will be it will prove its worth when the time is right. That we can keep the network alive, no matter what tries to be
Like
tries, yeah.
I guess it's something that happens quite often is, monopoly powers get disrupted.
Yeah.
And a really simple one would be cloud storage. Right now, it's like you've got the Google and the Apple. They like, oh, and Microsoft. Those three kind of dominate. So the US data centers dominate cloud storage because people buy it through their phone, their Google phone or their Apple phone, and that's how they get their cloud storage. What's cool about Nostr is like you can just choose a cloud service provider and you can just pay them sats to rent storage, and it's completely democratized the marketplace for storage. Right now, the Nostr providers aren't at the scale of the big providers, but the ease of use and the added benefit of some of them might be offering encrypted storage that you might trust a bit more than Google or Apple's encrypted storage. Or if you're just looking for like permanence of your data, you could pay to have it stored across multiple different services, which is really cool. But you don't have to do any extra work and upload it to each cloud, just that one post goes to the different the relays.
Yeah. No, that's really cool, man. But hey, look, I do want to circle back to this article. As I said before, we started recording, it was, someone sent this to me, and it's just dropped today, this morning. It was on the, was it investor.co.nz? And so we had Reserve Bank Governor Adrian Orr says stablecoins and cryptocurrencies are not a credible alternative to central bank money, is the title of the article. And what really stood out to me was a couple of things, and I hope we can talk about this. But firstly, I think the way that they conflated stablecoins and crypto, Bitcoin into this kind of statement, for me, it's kind of classic propaganda where you kind of choose the weak thing and then you associate the strong thing with the weak thing to make it out like the strong thing is also weak. And there's a whole page dedicated to shitting on stablecoins and talking about the New Zealand digital dollar that Easy Crypto are working on and a few things like that. But really what stood out to me was the fact that we had a MP, Stuart Smith, asking the RBNZ whether they were concerned about independent digital currencies replacing fiat money. And using the word fiat, I think, was, you know, it also quite illuminating. But then Adrian Orr saying concepts such as Bitcoin, it's neither a means of exchange, it's not a store of value, and it's not a unit of account, yet quite clearly it is. And so I just wonder what your thoughts are, James, on that article and sort of the precedent it set about Bitcoin being a talking point in, you know, in the New Zealand government and the New Zealand public sphere.
Yeah, I don't want to take the side of the central bank here, but I'm going to.
Just please steal, man. Yes.
Yeah. From the perspective of Adrian Orr, the New Zealand dollar, which we call the Kiwi, it's facing an existential threat. It's like the Kiwi, the bird, where it could go extinct. The threat isn't, from the perspective of the central bank, the threat isn't Bitcoin. The threat is the US dollar. I'm not trying to be political when I say that. I'm literally, that's what they're talking about. When they talk about wanting a CBDC, they're talking about trying to protect their monetary sovereignty. This was an early discussion the Reserve Bank talked about why they're studying CBDCs. And it's about the monetary sovereignty of New Zealand. And the analysts or the commentator at that time pointed out that what happens when a country's fiat currency fails is that it gets dollarized. And from the point of view of a Bitcoiner who in general doesn't like fiat currency because of the risk of debasement, you're just switching from having your local guys down in Wellington, our central bank, making the decision to debase it, to having the guys over in Washington making the decision to debase it. And so from the point of view of trying to protect the Kiwi dollar as New Zealand's sovereign currency, that's their agenda, and they have to play that role. Because if they give up, we do become dollarized, and the consequences of that would be, you know, we're the 51st state or we're just a territory, but we lose a lot of our independence in that way. But the independence that we're talking about here is a negative thing. It's our ability to unilaterally debase our currency when we want to. All political parties, none of them have come out against that power, because at the end of the day, they all want that in their back pocket as a bailout option for the country, debase the currency. And as we know from studying other countries in the world, if you're dollarized and your government has to borrow dollars, when you get into trouble because you mismanaged the country and you struggle to pay back that debt, you end up having to sell off a lot of the country. You sell off a lot of the key national strategic assets to pay back these loans. You get colonized through capitalism. Is one way to think about it.
That's an interesting take. And it says here, Adrian Orr said fiat currencies such as the New Zealand dollar had backing from Parliament and the RBNZ, who together could ensure the credibility of the currency across generations. And that sort of speaks to what you're saying. And I can see there's perhaps this kind of galactic battle taking place here, where these guys down in Wellington are thinking about, well, what's going to happen with the state of our current account? What's going to happen with exports, imports, all of these kinds of questions? And the Bitcoiners are just sort of sitting there, you know, taking pot shots, you know, and I sometimes take part in that myself, you know, with little comments here and there. But the reality is, you know, what you say is an interesting thesis, that it is the US dollar, which presents an existential challenge, and we've seen this with, you know, the 1980s as well. So
I don't personally see it being a negative thing if we become a state of the US. I don't really have an opinion on either way, one or the other. But I can see their point of view as their role as guardian of the New Zealand currency is to try keep the New Zealand currency competitive. We're a very small country. We're only 5 million people, but the Kiwi dollar is one of the 10th most liquid currencies in the world. We have a pretty good capital market where we do borrow. The government's able to borrow dollars out 10 years. I think they pushed it out to 20 years, able to borrow money. So the global economy, the global investor base, trusts New Zealand and lends us money. And right now we're at this kind of turning point with the interest rates where we're trying to talk down the interest rates. People look at the OCR, which is our cash rate that the central bank, the lever that the central bank pulls. People look at that and think, oh, the central bank controls interest rates. It controls overnight interest rates, which can affect the rest of the curve. But the reason interest rates came down in 2020 was because they printed 50 billion to lend to the government to suppress interest rates. The 10-year government bond in New Zealand at the start of 2020 was about 1% yield, spiked up to 2% when the COVID scare happened. So they immediately started printing and suppressed it down, held it below 1%. And the moment they stopped printing money to lend to the government, they were doing this to replace the demand that was missing from international investors. The international economy didn't have the money to lend to us, didn't want to lend money to us. They saw what our government was doing with the money, and they were like, we're going to need a higher interest rate if you want us to lend you money. So the central bank was stepping in to suppress interest rates to prevent them from spiking in 2020 during the COVID chaos. Once they stopped suppressing interest rates in early 2021, they took their foot off the gas, you could say, maybe. And then the 10-year government bond just went nuts. It went up to 5.5, 6% nearly the interest rate. They haven't printed money since then, and they want to reinstall that. That reflects a lack of confidence in the New Zealand government. That reflects a lack of creditworthiness to lend the New Zealand government money. People want a higher and higher return if they're going to lend money to New Zealand government because they're expecting inflation, because that's what they just saw, a whole bunch of money printing. Right now, everyone in the government, the current government and the central bank governor, are trying to talk down, they're trying to increase the credibility of New Zealand. And because they want interest rates to go down, and then as they start to go down and people start lending to New Zealand again, then they'll cut the front end interest rate. But they want to wait until they're certain that confidence is restored before they cut. So they're not going to cut too early. They're not going to, you know.
Yeah. Well,
So I'm rambling now.
no. Well, it's interesting you mention that because I've picked up just in terms of the language from our the mainstream media in New Zealand, which, as you know, is highly captured, and just sort of the rhetoric. Inflation is cooling. Households are feeling the pinch less. There was a recent webinar maybe a week ago. Paul Conway, chief economist of the Reserve Bank, was talking about. Really, as you say, kind of you're trying to talk it down and say, well, look, things are tough, and they use this kind of fluffy language to talk about, unemployment and stuff. But effectively, I think they are trying to operate on that sophistry level where they're trying to talk through it. And honestly, I think they're just under-equipped to do that. The only thing I've really got going for them is the compliance of the New Zealand mainstream media. And just I sat down and listened to some, this was painful, but I was listening to the Radio New Zealand trying to sort of break down that webinar, and it was like it's almost like they're on the books of the Reserve Bank to and what they're saying that I'm not really seeing any critical takes except from maybe some of the independent media people, but for the most part they're still playing within this kind of paradigm of we'll just let Wellington sort it out.
If we're too critical, we do risk blowing up the New Zealand dollar, the Kiwi, and then that's what they're worried about. So like the central bank, when that article made that comment, I don't know if it was Adrian or the article saying cryptocurrencies are not a substitute for fiat currency. They said something along those lines. They're actually absolutely right because they're talking about cryptocurrencies in the same way that I talk about cryptocurrencies, which is unregistered security tokens. There's a whole bunch of credit risk involved in these things. I don't view Bitcoin as being that. So when they say crypto can't replace fiat, it's one because the government wants a tool that it can print more of, and Bitcoin can't do that. But it's more like when you have a choice with who you hold your New Zealand dollar risk, your New Zealand dollar currency with, would you hold it with Easy Crypto, some startup with their NZDD, and then they invest it? You're taking the whole credit risk of that startup when the New Zealand Central Bank's direction that it's heading in is just hold it directly with us. We want consumers to have their currency held with the central bank.
Well, sorry, just I'm drilling into that. So I think to be clear here, the quote, I'm pretty sure this is Adrian Orr saying concepts such as Bitcoin, you know, it's not an exchange, it's not a store of value, and it's not a unit account, but people try to use it like that. And then I might have to dig into the original video to see exactly what else he said, but it really seems that the bulk of this particular article is focused on shitting on stable coins. And as you say, Easy Crypto, you know, a startup, they're still, I think it's that they've launched, but
so
maybe
like,
yeah.
The risk right now for the central bank is that we all start using US dollar Tether. That's the risk they're facing. And that is like having a bank account with a US financial company, except it's not regulated in the same way that JP Morgan is regulated. So there is that extra credit risk of how to Bitfinex or Tether, sorry, how to Tether manage that. I think they've been managing it well. They actually are over collateralized. They have billions of dollars more in assets than the liabilities. So if you look at it like a bank, it's better run than a bank. It's not fractionally reserved. It's fully backed. And the central bank is basically, because we're 5 million people, we're a small country, that role of having that custody is going to be done by our central bank. It's what they're trying to go for. Because right now, Tether is making, well, interest rates are so high in the US right now, they're making a whole bunch of free money by running that money market fund, where when you hold a Tether, you don't earn any interest on it. The company invests it into the money market funds, lends it to the government, and earns that interest rate, whatever the current rates are in the US. The argument that the central bank, I think, has, and it's quite right, is just hold it with them directly, and then maybe you'll earn the OCR. And then that's where they can really still control the market, because they can take the OCR positive or negative, so that cash balances, they can still control the direction of those.
Yeah. Well, on that note, so I think the challenge I see as well is just from the technology perspective, and we may have talked about this previously as well, but looking at just the capabilities of the Reserve Bank of New Zealand, you know, as you said, it's a small country, and even the capabilities of the government more broadly, I certainly, from my experience working with people who in government and kind of understanding the way things happen, I certainly don't think we have the technical capability to deploy this. And so my expectation is that there will be a provider, and I believe it will be an offshore provider who's providing the technical backbone of this. And so there's a certain question around sovereignty there. I don't think this is going to be, you know, the DevOps team at Reserve Bank deploying this stuff.
Well, okay, to defend them here,
yeah.
I think it has been a great idea that they haven't acted on it until now, because if they'd acted on this 3 years ago, they would have ended up putting the Kiwi on Ethereum or some bullshit, right? They would have made the token on some controlled network where, exactly right, you're beholden to that offshore investor, that offshore cartel that controls that protocol. The CBDC, the Kiwi dollar, for it to be successful and to actually contest against the US dollar, it's going to have to move on the fastest, cheapest rails, which is going to be a Bitcoin layer two, whether that's Liquid or whether that's on the Lightning via Taro, which is another way of putting assets on Lightning. And by waiting until now, the central bank can actually act very quickly with the right technology. And let's say it goes for, let's say we create our own federation in New Zealand. You know, we call it KBTC. So instead of Liquid BTC, LBTC, we have KBTC. And the central bank would use the open source elements, the open source Liquid protocol that Blockstream have developed, but they would run it themselves, and they would control who are the federation members, which would very likely be our deposit institutions, which is all our Australian, New Zealand, and US banks that have the right to hold Kiwi dollars. They can still control the group of authorized participants in this market. So they run the Kiwi network, the Kiwi version of Liquid. Suddenly, all of the Kiwi banks and Australian banks, everyone who accepts New Zealand dollars in New Zealand, they all can now offer Bitcoin on their own federated chain where they can peg in and out from on-chain Bitcoin to Kiwi Bitcoin. The custody of it is now protected by New Zealand's regulations where it's only these authorized participants and it's a multi-signature. So it's basically saying you'll lose your Bitcoin if 9 out of 12 of New Zealand's banks try to scam you. Oh, hopefully it doesn't happen. And then once they're running KBTC, they can do those swaps into Lightning and they can provide people with Lightning payment access across the world. And they can do it with your point of view, with your New Zealand bank account, you know, your Kiwi Bank wallet app. It will show you New Zealand dollars, it will show you Kiwi, but you can go and pay a Lightning invoice because it can do the swap into Bitcoin, KBitcoin, and pay the Lightning invoice using the same way that Aqua, that wallet, is doing it now using Liquid Bitcoin. We could do the same thing. And so if they're worried about offshore interests controlling our financial system, well, that's why they could run their own federation. And if they're worried about being beholden to offshore developers developing that technology, well, that's why it's open source and anyone can contribute to it. And that's why it's had 5 years of proving out now.
Yeah, that's a fascinating thesis, man. KBTC. I coming back though to what I was saying before, though, is like, I just don't think from the material that I've been exposed to, I don't think they're seeing it like that. Like, I still think there's this exploration of the CBDC is very much rooted in the kind of the viewpoint of the Reserve Bank at the center. You know, there's technology on the periphery, there's tokens, there's all of this kind of classic crypto stuff. And for them, you know, again, the conversation that comes to mind is that they're going to go to Binance for a bunch of crooks associated with money laundering in the US and all of that stuff as someone who actually has the ability to build a stack, something like BNB. You know, and it's kind of going to be this pink elephant that doesn't really do anything. And that, you know, to expose them to something like Liquid or a federated approach, I mean, that's revolutionary thinking. Is it going to take a black swan? Is it going to take some massive external push to get you in there to explain to them what they need to actually be doing? You know what I mean?
I think it's, you know, we might try something that fails, but we'll eventually find the right solution that works if we want the Kiwi to exist. Otherwise, the Kiwi will fail, and that's a future timeline too, where the Kiwi fails and we use dollars. What? But if we want the Kiwi to survive, it's eventually going to have to find this solution, and it will just copy what the US dollar is doing to remain competitive with it. The US doesn't talk about in a positive light Tether, but Tether has helped the US dollar tremendously. Tether is now one of the top 20 holders of US government bonds. It has $90 billion in dollars in assets. It's the reason why the US dollar is still the global reserve fiat currency, because the crypto Bitcoin space, which is global, when they want to go stable, which I agree with, the central bank is not stable, it's actually fiat pegged. When they want to go pegged, they're pegging to dollars because it's the easiest way to do it. As a Kiwi, we might prefer to peg to Kiwi because our outgoing expenses are in Kiwi. Our country runs in Kiwi.
Yeah. Interesting. So I just wonder, again, public sentiment. We were saying before how there's so much happening, it's hard to kind of wrap your head around. But I mean, these conversations are happening and they're getting a tiny little bit of media coverage. I think this is a really powerful step. As I said, the fact that they're using the word fiat in this article, the fact that they're talking about Bitcoin, the words Bitcoin are being uttered from these people's mouths. I mean, that's step one. But the broader conversation around inflation, cost of living, you know, as you know, I'm overseas at the moment, and I'm constantly shocked at how interesting the dynamic is where I'm spending New Zealand dollars overseas, and I'm not exposed to the inflation that's happening in New Zealand. So my purchasing power is in a very different space to a lot of other people. And I still, you know, I every now and then people tell me, oh, you know, this is how much a jug of milk is costing, or, you know, to go and have a coffee. And I'm feeling just a lot of pain and sort of a lot of brokenness, especially as we came through Waitangi Day, talking about infrastructure issues, all of this stuff. And I'm like, man, what is the basket case that is New Zealand? What is the pathway out of this? It seems like people are beginning to think about Bitcoin stuff. We're seeing price rallies happen as well. It's going to be a topic on people's minds. I mean, where do things go from here in terms of the kind of the public discourse?
Well, we, citizens of New Zealand, we exerted our power in October or November last year when we fired half of the outgoing government. They lost half their seats in parliament. So we've already punished the government for its policy. And now we have a new government. I mean, we all know secretly it's all more of the same, really. They don't have much difference in foreign policy. They're probably going to want to print money at some point too. But the attitude that the government has taken now, this new government, is to be to try and promise us they're going to be better with our money. And so the tide has already turned in that direction. Prices are coming down. I would say the deflationary bust, you know, the crash in prices that happens after those big bubbles caused by the central bank printing, I would say that's already happened, but it hasn't been talked about in the media yet. The media is always late to the party. It's kind of actually happened. If you look at it just in terms of home values in New Zealand, the market collapsed massively. The inflationary pressures, like, it's... The price of coffee rose in 2020 and 2021, but since 2022 and 2023, it's kind of held. Like, it's actually, the pressures have eased, and the bust that we're seeing is everyone's going bankrupt because the interest rates have still been high for this long. If your business can't operate in that high cost of capital environment, if you're not generating a higher return than the 5 or 6% you can get risk-free at the government, you're not going to be able to refinance your business and keep going. So a lot of people have been put out of business. A lot of prices have been crashing. A lot of car importers are overstocked and prices have come down. I mean, EV sales are down 90% in January versus the year before. That number might not be accurate. It was something like 80% or something. So I think New Zealand's doing the healing now. It's going through the pain. We're going to have the storylines this year of the pain. They're going to talk more about the bust. And that's when... people start being happy earning their 5% from the government. They start, international investors start lending money to the government. Interest rates come back down and the central bank cuts interest rate at some point. The economy has the ability very easily to grow out of the situation. If you think about the size of the country, we call ourselves small, but we are ginormous. We are a huge country and our natural resource wealth is second to none in the world. We have phenomenal amount of resources, untapped potential, including energy, which is what Bitcoin is going to help fund the development of. So we can pay back our debt, New Zealand. We can very easily pay back our debt with good management. The risk is if we have mismanagement and we start printing money again and go nuts with it, but we can pay back our debt. And if we really wanted to, we could open our border and 10x our population because we can fit 50 million in New Zealand, even though we've only got 5 million now in terms of land. We couldn't do that because we don't have the ability to build enough houses for those people. But the case for New Zealand in the long term, when you step back, is like a phenomenal growth story, especially as the world map shifts, where the traditional world map has America on the left, Asia and Europe, and then you've got New Zealand down the bottom right. I would say the map is shifting where the Pacific Rim is becoming more central because of the relationship between the US and Asia, and we benefit from that being right in the middle. We're already seeing a huge amount of American immigration to New Zealand. It's actually crazy how many American accents you hear. And we're already seeing the, not colonialism, but we are seeing the US companies enter New Zealand. Costco has entered and is disrupting the supermarket industry massively. So like, there's a huge growth story here.
Yeah, that's interesting. I wonder, we're entering into new territory there, talking about kind of immigration policy, kind of growth vectors, what good growth and what is, what's good growth and what's, not good growth, if there's such a thing, kind of the empty calories of importing people who are a net benefit, a net drain? I mean, even the paradigm of like looking at that, like how do you talk about that? I think that's a whole nother thing. But coming back to kind of what the opportunities are for New Zealand, so you talk about energy and natural resources, and that's something that's big on my mind when we talk about Bitcoin mining and kind of that as an export industry, because KBTC or whatever, at the end of the day, New Zealand is a net importer of Bitcoin at the moment, and so you go through Easy Crypto basically to buy your Bitcoin,
Yep, you're
and
selling your Kiwi to buy US dollars to buy Bitcoin. Yep.
as you mentioned last time, you're mainlining basically Binance wholesale Bitcoin through these this outfit. And so what would it mean though to actually have that Bitcoin local and be exporting it? And so zooming out to some of the opportunities. So, as you know, I talked to Prince Philip of Serbia the other week and talking about the opportunities for nation state adoption and kind of how these conversations take place, because I think there's an opportunity with the accessibility of New Zealand politicians and leaders. We can kind of go and knock on their door and talk to them. They're not in this high echelon, upper, Senate kind of thing where we can't even get access. They're literally down at the coffee shop and on Lambton Quay. On a Friday afternoon sort of thing. So there is this accessibility of leaders, and the energy story, which is a big thing, more broadly infrastructure, but energy in particular, being able to say, hey, New Zealand's got a lot of really, really good natural resources, already in place, hydro schemes and things. What does it look like to actually start promoting that and kind of bring it out of the shadows? Because I think there is some Bitcoin mining taking place, as you know, publicly, and then I think there's also quite a bit happening sort of privately, as in it's not being talked about. But I think actually being able to bring that into light and say, hey, this is a growth industry that we really want to see some more stuff happen. I'm not expecting subsidies or anything like that, but I'm saying, what does it mean to actually be acknowledging that
It's
publicly?
crazy because they wouldn't need to subsidize it.
That's
Bitcoin
right.
miners would already be willing to come in and invest and build the mines. So it comes back to like policy, and we can talk about do we need a politician from the top down to create a policy to just make Bitcoin happen? But then the discussion becomes, well, what is the best Bitcoin policy? And until we can come up with good policy to suggest to them, it's not nothing's going to happen. Their politicians are listening. They want to hear good policy suggestions. And maybe the way we do it really is what we already are doing, which is this new government's really trying to reform some of the restrictions that are holding back the development of more energy in New Zealand. And so they're trying to reform the Resource Management Act, and they're trying to encourage a lot of investment into new renewable generation in the country. Now, the natural consequence of that is the company that goes on that private endeavor to raise capital to build the new hydro dam or build the new geothermal or build the offshore wind farm, that company is going to either be a Bitcoin miner or be selling to a Bitcoin miner in order to pay for that development of that new energy source. But that and other things, there's going to be the hydrogen plants, which are already becoming a thing in New Zealand. That's another thing that just requires low electricity costs to make its product. So like Bitcoin, there's nothing in New Zealand's law saying Bitcoin mining is prohibited. So it's nothing stopping it from happening. It's just waiting for the market to really grow and for more of that to happen. It's like a natural consequence is going to be a lot more Bitcoin mining here, I think.
I agree. I agree with that. I mean, obviously, there's a market for this stuff, and it is legal. People are doing it out there, as we know. But I guess coming back to this kind of narrative approach, which is still relevant, I think, the way things are talked about, and talking about the way that the Reserve Bank's use of words in terms of the New Zealand dollar, coming back to the New Zealand government's approach and saying something as simple as, we're open for Bitcoin mining as a statement, even though that's obviously true as of today. But kind of the public sentiment around that and sort of the discourse, because at the moment, I think it's talked about, or it's not talked about at a policy level, whereas something along the lines of Minister of Energy says, Minister of whatever says, Bitcoin mining is a real big opportunity, and we're excited to see what happens. That statement, that's front page news for Bitcoiners. And I don't know, like, how do you engage with that apparatus? Because we're still a bunch of individuals here trying to see this succeed, and deep down, I would like to see New Zealand make it. And so, what do we do to make
Well,
that?
as much as the current government might secretly love Bitcoin, the reason they're not coming out and making a statement like that is how easy it is for the opposition to jump on it and whip up all that hysteria about, oh, they're going to try kill the planet, boiling the oceans. So right now, the less attention there is to Bitcoin, but just making sure they're not getting in the way of letting it happen, it's good.
That's a
It
good, that's a good,
happens. Yeah.
yeah, that's a good point. So maybe like nuts and bolts of policy, as long as it's legal and it hasn't been,
Yeah.
written out, if effectively is what you're saying, is it, and then it just needs to survive. Bitcoin miners who know what's up and know that it's all good to go. You can get the stuff into the country, you can be plugging it in, you can be organizing stuff with the power generators.
And Bitcoin miners are looking for a stable government that's going to allow them to operate for 50 to 100 years without, confiscating their mine and nationalizing it. And that's where just the general principle of a government that protects private property rights is absolutely key. And that's the direction the current government is trying to go in. Every time they talk about private property rights, and I don't want to get into this particular political issue, but Article either 2 or 3 of the Treaty of Waitangi about the protecting our individual chieftainship over our assets, that's private property rights. That's a beautiful thing for us to enshrine as our founding constitutional kind of document, because it protects all of us and our private assets from the government, and that's beneficial. In terms of specific policies that they could do to encourage Bitcoiners to come to New Zealand, they don't have to lay out the welcome mat and say anything. They could. That would get the hype up. But what they could do is, like the facility to exchange. So the Bitcoin miners are going to owe New Zealand dollars for taxes, right? The facility, if the central bank, I mean, this is wishful thinking, but if the central bank set up a facility where you could sell them Bitcoin and get New Zealand dollars at the current fair market value based on the current exchange rate of New Zealand dollars to US dollars, that provides the infinite bottomless liquidity. So no matter how much Bitcoin you mine, you can immediately convert it into New Zealand dollars to pay your bills, to pay your employees, without going through a very complicated selling it for US dollars, losing 0.5% there, transferring it to New Zealand dollars, losing 0.5% there. Like, if the central bank facilitated Bitcoin to New Zealand dollar exchange, it would be pretty interesting, because it would also mean that those New Zealand dollars that are being created to buy the Bitcoin are receiving Bitcoin into the central bank's reserves in return. So you're backing the dollar, the Kiwi dollar, you're backing it with Bitcoin.
Yeah, I see what you mean. So
That's
like
probably
a,
it. Yeah.
yeah, or like a specific function, and it would
Yeah.
be this, back of the book, unless you needed to use it, you wouldn't know about it. It wouldn't really be public news. It would be this functionality, as you say, that means you're avoiding some of that over the counter fees associated with going into US dollars and then back, and all of the transfer fees and stuff.
And
You mainline
from the
it.
point of view of the central bank, having Bitcoin, having miners selling you Bitcoin, you're giving them Kiwi dollars, which you can create out of thin air. You're getting Bitcoin in return, which is really good reserve to have in your reserves, because you can liquidate it immediately on the global markets for US dollars or for Japanese yen. You can do what you want with it. And so it's like, I see it happening. But like you said, when we listen to the Reserve Bank and the way they're talking now, it doesn't seem very clear that they're even thinking about this. But the way I see it happening is more of like out of necessity or inevitability. And we shouldn't knock the Reserve Bank in its attitude towards stablecoins and crypto, because they're more talking about the competition amongst private banks. And they're talking about New Zealand's market right now is 80% captured by Australian banks. Those Australian banks don't pass on the full OCR to their customers. They make the largest net interest margin anywhere in the world here in New Zealand. So we're paying the most for banking services in New Zealand. Like, we're getting milked. So the central bank, and especially Adrian Orr, who is absolutely the nicest guy you'll ever meet, he has good intentions. The play that's been in play for 20 years is Kiwi Bank. Before Kiwi Bank, we did have our own bank, National Bank, but that was acquired by an Australian bank. We lost our little bit of our home player when that was lost to ANZ. Kiwi Bank was started, and it was actually like Adrian Orr had probably a part to play because at that time he was running the New Zealand Superannuation Fund and investing capital to fund a New Zealand-owned bank. And then now, once he moved over to the Reserve Bank of New Zealand, Kiwi Bank has now been totally absorbed into New Zealand government, wholly owned by New Zealand government. So Kiwi Bank is like the retail CBDC arm of the central bank. And so it's now a really strong competitor to try and get its market share up from like 15, 20% of New Zealand market, to try and get it up a bit higher, to try offer us all better financial services and to protect us from the censorship that those foreign companies can do. Because if you're a New Zealand citizen, the law could say you can never be banned from using Kiwi dollars. And so that's one way they're thinking about the currency too. Like they're thinking about, we want it to be controlled by a New Zealand-owned entity so that it's our policies and our protection of our New Zealand citizens that we're able to enforce. And I guess when I take a step back and think about the role of Bitcoin and CBDCs, it's like how the internet, you might not want your kid to have full access to the uncensored internet. You might prefer your underage kid to use YouTube for kids or Netflix for kids or safe search on Google or whatever. CBDC is that. CBDC is the protected kindergarten training wheels money that kids and young people can use that can have heavy restrictions on how it's used, and that's their intention, to steer the capital in the direction they want it to go, especially if they're giving out money for free through some kind of benefit. They want that money to go to the things that they want. So they don't want it to go and be lost into the vices like the gambling industry or the liquor industry. They want it to go and pay for food, so that, or pay for the kids' school lunch, or pay for the kids' clothing. So it's like I think the central bank is fighting a different fight than what we're thinking about, and it's not really any of our business to worry about it. It's just happening. It's going to happen regardless of,
That's a
what we do.
fascinating perspective, man. Like, I can kind of see what you mean. Like, when you approach this kind of a real politic, kind of narrative shaping lens on what they're doing and what they're saying, there's certainly considerations that are on their mind that as a Bitcoiner, we say, oh, we don't care about that, whatever. But actually, there is material impact on, the vast majority of New Zealanders. And what you're talking about with the Australian banks is, a huge point of contention, because we're seeing just geopolitically, what WTF is Australia doing in terms of China, in terms of everything. And New Zealand kind of has a slightly different foreign policy, a slightly different role in the world. We sort of see ourselves, I still think, obviously within the Five Eyes and all of that, but certainly we're not super aligned with Australia on some of its policies. And so having Australian banks, which are also very much more advanced with their CBDCs and some of their censorship as well of bank accounts, we're seeing that come out of Australia now. What is the flow-on effect for New Zealanders if there's issues upstream? And I don't see them stabbing us in the back or anything, but.
It's about keeping the policy control in New Zealand voters' hands. If we lost the Kiwi and we were dollarized, do you think that the 5 million people on the outskirts of the US empire would have any say over what Washington spends its money on? Doesn't matter whether it's Democrats, Republicans, or independent candidates running the US. We're the small little outpost.
Well, it's I
Whereas,
mean, it's like Puerto Rico. I mean, they're not even a state, but they dollarize. They're part of the United States Empire, and I don't know how many millions of people they've got in their territory.
So by defending our currency and defending our kind of sovereignty, which it helps afford to us as people, we retain the ability to sack the government and replace them with a different one that has a different policy agenda, different spending, and we control. Like, we were able to switch our government in October, and in 3 years or 4 years, we'll be able to do it again. But we would feel so powerless if we didn't have that. Like, if you were electing a government, but they didn't actually control the money supply, then you're not actually having any say over whether the money gets to base to fund a war over in the Middle East. That's just going to happen regardless of you. preference.
That's pretty powerful, because I guess you could say this was a response to what the Labor government did in during the COVID era. Was we said, hey, we've had enough of this, and we sacked them. But we couldn't do the same thing for what the United States is on its adventures in the
We're
Middle
5 million
East.
votes. We've got no voice. In terms of the 350 US citizens, the 5 million, we wouldn't have much of a voice. But like, I shouldn't be too hard on Labor and say we sacked them. It's more like, it's good to change government so the other people have a turn. And we actually don't know how bad it could have been in 2020 if they didn't print that money then. So that's their defense.
Well, it's hard to run the counterfactual. But I guess just pulling on that thread a little bit more, because there's certainly some interesting points there around the narrative and how it plays out. Because I think I am aware that there is a way of talking about these things, and there is I guess kind of almost protocol for how you roll out conversations. Because as you say, it'd be easier for the opposition to pick up and take a shot at it. If they were to come out and talk about Bitcoin in a very public way, similar to, El Salvador or these other places. And those countries have their own configuration, which means that is acceptable. That's worked for them. But I guess the conservative nature, the lack of public awareness, even, the articles we're talking about here are not front page news. They're, back of the business edition, back of the, you know, back of the newspaper kind of thing. And so they're not. There's not of an awareness to even talk about it publicly, and so that could be a real threat, as you say, to someone coming out, even if these MPs are actually have been briefed on it, they understand the power of Bitcoin, but they're just kind of keeping their heads down.
Like, it's up to us to orange pill our country, to make it popular to use Bitcoin, and the politics follows the popularity. That it'll happen as long as we orange pill people and people start zapping sats and using Bitcoin. They understand the volatility of it. They understand that maybe there's still a place for CBDCs or whatever. Like, we just have to get people using Bitcoin, liking Bitcoin, so that politicians don't have any political risk at all to talk positively about it. And anyone that uses Bitcoin can see, like, when they use it properly, when they actually get on Noster and they zap some sats, or they use it properly in the sense of long-term HODL, store of value, they see its positive benefits, and the tide will turn very quickly. It's like anything that was once unpopular, but when it becomes popular, it could turn very quickly.
Yeah, that's the sentiment, and I think that comes back to what we were talking about at the beginning. That's sort of what's starting to. I get this feeling just sort of in my gut. I don't quite know how to describe it, but it's like the dollar price continues to increase, and people are like, "Oh, okay." Cody was talking about this a year ago. He was talking about it 18 months ago, but now I'm starting to see, and I'm starting to be aware, and I want to know more. I want to know where to
Coffee's
buy.
getting cheaper for us. It's,
Yeah, well.
deflation's,
Yeah, and then you look at cost of living and you think, man, everyone's struggling with their you talk about deflation. I think it's more disinflationary. I guess price is still increasing, but they're just not going up as fast. But there's challenges with people's daily cost of living, right? And so if you say, hey, there's this other thing that you can start saving in, why don't you give it a go? And now that there's actually the kind of proof of concept of it's gone back up, and it's now at this price that you didn't think it was going to go back to, have you changed your mind? Are you willing to look into it? We've got, unfortunately, still not quite a huge a range of options for purchasing in New Zealand in terms of how someone gets their hands on it, but you do a bit of research and you learn how you can
You
do
know,
that.
the New Zealand dollar CBDC, the Kiwi dollar, could really help with that because it would be able to be swapped for Bitcoin in the same way that US dollar Tether is swapped for Bitcoin through a competitive market of all these brokerages using these decentralized swaps. Like, it would become a lot easier to access it once they properly digitize these Kiwi dollar.
Well, there's another piece of tech. I interviewed a guy, Andrew Begin from Galloy recently, and they're doing the Blink Wallet, and they've got the stable sats
Stable
functionality.
sats,
Yeah. And I have you had a go with that? Are you familiar with that concept?
So this is where I am going to take the side of the central bank when they make the criticism that these products have credit risk. And Galoi, Blink, They are very upfront and honest about that on their website. The way they offer you stable sats is that the Bitcoin you give them, they put it on one of those exchanges that have perpetual Bitcoin derivatives. That's a credit risk. You know, FTX disappeared, Binance could disappear tomorrow, Deribit, whatever one they're using, there's a credit risk there. So a stable sat is a higher credit risk than a CBDC, because the company that's holding that money for you could lose that money, whereas the central bank can't lose the money, that they just print more.
Yeah. Well, I thought it was an interesting concept though, because they're using OKC, I think, is the exchange. And he talked about maybe future versions where you can, have a number of exchanges that are sort of lumped together, so that these short positions are more evenly distributed across a number of players. And so there's some innovation there, but the use case really is, people who don't want to see the volatility, and they're dealing in small amounts of sats. Maybe they're in one of these Latin American countries or whatnot.
Yeah,
But
and there's a benefit of you don't necessarily have to use a CBDC. You're probably going to be KYC'd. It's all very above board, and you're going to have to pay taxes on it. To use a stable sat or some of these peg tokens like Tether, it's a bit freer in its movement. And so there's that advantage. So while you're taking a credit risk, you might also not be taking a kind of surveillance risk, maybe you could call it. Yeah, but it should offer you a higher interest rate for doing that, because you are still taking a risk, but
that's
that's
interesting.
where it
What?
becomes the yield thing.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, interest rate. I mean, the way I see it though is being able to access that. I've got that just playing around with it on my phone. Put 5,000 sats into the Lightning account, and then 5,000 sats into the stable sats account. And we know which one's doing better now, but it's interesting to.
Actually, yeah, I was
Sorry,
going
I
to
was.
say that's a good advantage, is the cheapness with which you might be able to swap in and out of Bitcoin to the stable sat. The low transaction cost could be one of the advantages too.
Yeah, and getting the exposure to that synthetic USD, which, again, you and I, we play around with PayPal, we play around with all these other sort of services, but actually this is non-KYC, it's easy peasy. And if there are challenges with the New Zealand dollar, which, black swan event, whatever, we stop selling milk, then what are you going to do, and how do you get exposure? And I think what we're seeing is it's almost like these kind of holes are starting to form in your ability to get exposure to other currencies, where 5 years ago, it was pretty hard for people to even think about what they would do if they weren't using New Zealand dollars. Whereas I can tell anyone, hey man, just go and get a Blink wallet on your phone, and you can get these synthetic USD, and it's going to be available to you, and you can peg in and out of it with Bitcoin. So you can go and buy Bitcoin on the market, then you can get the synthetic USD, and it's kind of this optionality. It's sort of going from a singular to a very pluralistic options for how you interface with global currencies.
Yeah, it's like with the Aqua wallet, you can swap between liquid Bitcoin and liquid Tether pretty cheaply and quickly. It's a competitive market making that happens behind the scenes to provide the swap. So right now it's not quite at the spot rate. There is a fee. But the difference there would be US dollar Tether, for all its negative media that it gets, it is still a money market fund that actually holds US dollars with the treasury to back it. So it's got a lower credit risk than an offshore derivative exchange that allows gambling on cryptocurrencies other than Bitcoin, where the house, you know how FTX kind of went under because the house, the insider hedge fund, went under. Some of these offshore exchanges could go under, and that could really affect the value of your stable sat. But there's always different risks and different trade-offs. But yeah, I mean, the goal would be for the central bank to, so that's US dollars, right? US dollar has so much utility compared to Kiwi dollar with these examples we've just talked about. We have to catch up. We have to get the Kiwi up there so that Kiwis can stable sat, or they can swap their Bitcoin into Kiwi dollars when they want to help with their consumption smoothing. So Bitcoin, it's still a bit volatile. It's still early decades of Bitcoin's journey. And having that instant access to just be like, oh, cool, Bitcoin's up today. It's at 50,000 US. I have a car payment or I have a insurance payment next month. I got a $1,000 payment. Why don't I get that $1,000 now so that I've covered my outgoing ahead of time? That frictionless swapping between Bitcoin and fiat is lots of utility there.
Yeah. Well, look, man, I think there's a lot to think about here. I like the approach of, I mean, I think it's a sophisticated way of looking at it where you sort of put on the hat of the Reserve Bank and say, okay, from their seat on up on the terrace in Wellington, what are they seeing? What's on their radar? And ultimately, is there a collaborative approach there that's available? Because I think the alternative of being a vassal state of the United States, for example, and being proxy to their wars and all of their shenanigans, is not really something that New Zealand's ever been part of. And if we go back
And
to
we say that with
the,
no disrespect to the United States. We love
that's right.
our American
We love our
friends,
American
but it's
friends.
kind of like the same way that some of the states like to be their own country and have their own rules. We like to have our own rules here too, and we like currently having our own currency as well, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously, we're not shitting on individuals here, but it's just the concept of empire is something New Zealand, we've had enough of that. And so coming back to something like the treaty as well, which, the way I read it, talk about rangatira tanga, for me, that's like, well, sovereignty for all of us from not being part of whoever, whether it's the British Empire or the American one. I think, Kiwis, as we are today, we can demand that, and it's enshrined in the treaty that we should have
It's
self-sovereignty.
literally putting sovereign individual as our constitution.
That's what it translates as, eh? It's rangatiratanga, self-sovereignty. So I think we can all take that, and I think this kind of culture war around what that means for Maori and non-Maori and that is a bit of a smokescreen. I think we can all lay claim to it and say, look, we're all fucking self-sovereign. And so let's do the thing that is self-sovereign, or we're going to do it anyway. And what you're talking about with kind of the engagement, I feel like it's educational. I feel like Binance and Easy Crypto are the ones who are whispering in the ear of the advisories and the working groups in the Reserve Bank. I mean, I don't know, are they really getting exposed to the cutting edge of what we're seeing with Bitcoin? What are the conduits for that knowledge to kind of make its way into their room?
Oh,
I
look,
don't.
I'm sure there's people in Wellington listening to your podcast and learning a lot. So we just gotta, we don't have to have faith. We just have to know that the good things are happening in New Zealand, and there's smart people in every aspect of New Zealand, and no one's trying to scam each other. Well, people are scamming each other, but the government has got its role to play, and these people have a very hard task of being accountable to the media and having to answer all these horrible, pesky questions. They've got people yelling in the air all the time, do this, do that, and they might know instinctively that the things they've been pitched by from Binance are not going to work. But they don't have the better pitches coming from the Bitcoiners yet. But it's because Bitcoin is not captured by a company. There's no company pitching the government to try to get them to use their software. But it's a protocol, and it's just about education, I guess. People over time will catch up, we'll get it.
Yeah, there is an opportunity, I think, for New Zealand to lead with some of this, and we saw it in the past with FPOS and other initiatives. And so, yeah, putting it out there, kind of the olive branch that look, there is people out there like yourself, and other guests that I've had on the show who I think are extremely knowledgeable about what this could mean. And it is, as you say, problematic though when you've got a very biased media and kind of a very anti-government media. I think that's been quite a commentary is that the mainstream media in New Zealand, for some reason, really hate the national-led coalition. And so any opportunity to shit on that will be taken by the media, and that's got ramifications, even though we've got, a couple of years left of this term. It's problematic.
I mean, with media, views versus influence are different things, and some journalists might just not get it, and they might come across as being pessimistic or attacking Bitcoin all the time, and they don't get it, and that's fine. Other journalists, other independent journalists like yourself, I say the word journalist, but you are getting it, right?
Thank
And you're
you.
putting out high signal content. So the truth is out there, the truth makes its way. And those media outlets we just, you know, they're losing their respect a bit, and they're losing their views, and they're losing their signal, and they'll eventually start hiring people, or their own people will start getting more educated. I had one thought just before when you were talking about New Zealand leading the way. So one analogy I have with what's happening with CBDCs in New Zealand, this might be a bad analogy, but when the internet rollout was happening in New Zealand, the fiber internet rollout, we had a monopoly, Telecom, which controlled the internet service retailer and the internet infrastructure, the copper wires for ADSL internet. The government intervened, broke it up, and made the infrastructure provider its own entity called Chorus, and allowed other infrastructure providers to compete too, but it broke it up. And we as a country got fiber across the country pretty quickly compared to other parts of the world. We have some world-leading internet here. And that is kind of like the central bank taking the deposit taking part of a retail bank, those Australian banks, their deposit taking business, taking that and putting that into Kiwi Bank and the central bank is like taking the infrastructure, the fiber, and making that a government initiative, and then allowing all the competing banks or all the competing internet service providers to resell the internet on top of that. So it's like, there's potential for massive disruption to the banks and their business model and their free ride that they might have been having. And so that's why there's a lot of criticism of CBDCs also coming from the private banking industry.
Interesting, and it's sort of this unbundling. I mean, just one little anecdote on that. I remember I was having a drink. I was visiting Auckland a couple of years ago, and I was having a drink at this little place up, might have been Federal Street. This guy was in there. He's like a banker. I think it might have been with ANZ, quite high level. And we, started chatting, and he was explaining how New Zealanders don't realize just how much they're being milked with the mortgages and all of that stuff. Compared to what you're paying in Australia, because we have no say, we have no vote, effectively. And so that always stuck with me as kind of symptomatic of this bigger challenge as New Zealand tries to forge its own path as a small nation, independent rangatiratanga. Unbundling it, is going to be really powerful. And perhaps what we could look at, again, if I put on the hat of the Reserve Bank and from my position, ultimately, I think these are good, pragmatic people, and I look at the human aspect of it. And I think, generally speaking, I like Kiwis. I love my fellow countrymen. And I think there is an opportunity to build something here because I really don't want to see New Zealand turn into a shithole. We've got broken roads at the moment, but we've still got spirit. And I think there's something that could kind of be quite unifying about that. Other countries have their own challenges internally, but I feel deep down New Zealand is an integrated, peaceful, connected society, and there's something about it. You meet a Kiwi overseas, and it's like, it's not, there's not a sense of anger or hate or anything. It's like, yeah, if you're a Kiwi, let's go and grab a beer, have a barbecue. That, there's something about that camaraderie, which I think we can lean into to actually build a country that's suitable for the 21st century's economic climate, which is changing very rapidly.
And nothing we've talked about today, even though I've come across very pro central bank, which is very unlike me, but nothing we've talked about today is undermining Kiwis in their independence and their ability to choose to store their wealth in Bitcoin if they want to. And you know, we now have, if you want to do a forced TODL, like a retirement savings plan, our KiwiSaver plans now in New Zealand, where your employer will contribute into it as well to pay for your retirement, you can now have Bitcoin in that, the Bitcoin ETFs. You know, that's over in the US, which is, yeah, but it's, you can do that now. So like we can get people exposed to Bitcoin as a store of value through something that's quite still regulated and protects them from themselves. It just stores their value until they retire. That orange pills them a bit with the growth story of Bitcoin. Then we get them also at the same time earning a few little sats on the new internet. The likes that they get on Twitter are now zaps on Noster. So people are earning sats now, and then they start spending sats. But sats, it's still early days for Bitcoin, so it will be volatile. So there's still going to be people using fiat. It's just what's happening.
Well, I mean, there's a Bitcoin ETF exposure, as you say, but I'm pretty sure there's a Kōra already had Bitcoin in its portfolio. That was one of the managed funds that are available, and that's been very at least a
So the
year.
big kind of win with Bitcoin ETFs is that these are large US financial institutions that have lowered the fee
The
dramatically,
management fees, yeah.
management fee. And the thing that kills you with index funds or any kind of investing is the management fee. Not kills you, sorry, but hurts your returns tremendously is the management fee. So by having a really competitive market of these largest US financial institutions all trying to compete each other and drive the fees down to zero, the management fee is now 0.25% per year. Add on top of that your little KiwiSaver provider taking their little clip, but you could effectively get exposure potentially to a 100% Bitcoin KiwiSaver, an Orange Saver, for like 0.5% management fee each year. So it's quite low. And then when you're 65, you have this wealth that then pays you your income to pay for your retirement. Or in the meantime, during the bulls and bears of Bitcoin, New Zealand allows you to dip into your retirement savings to buy a house. So I could see a lot of Kiwis doing that. They could have Bitcoin as their KiwiSaver, and then during a bull market, they buy a house, and that could be how people get into their first house.
And that would align quite well with just cultural values around home ownership and the kind of narrative around that, because it's certainly a challenge, right? But if you've got young people right now who are opting in for some of these, what do they call them? Not risky funds, but you could choose your KiwiSaver risk level, and so
Yeah.
you opt into one of these, say give it 5 years. If you're in the Orange fund, there
Right,
you go. That's your
have the
first
house,
home.
yeah.
Yeah, first home buyer. That's fascinating stuff. Like, and I really appreciate it, James. The sophistication of your thinking here, because I think it is there's something to be said about being able to put that hat on of these other parties who are, managing complex scenarios, which they get paid a lot of money to do that. But I can only imagine how stressful it must be to be reporting to the government, to the media, to the public, and being able to manage that, because literally they're having to pull it, like they got one lever now for managing like all of this stuff, and it's like, oh, what do we do? And being able to sort of do the game theory and think about where they're at, and also being open to kind of seeing where there's synergy and collaboration possible, because I don't think burning the whole thing down in any sense is ever going to work. It's going to be a case of working together collaboratively, building this thing out, educating. And then we see that bright orange future emerging.
Yeah, like the world right now is very, conflict everywhere. Each nation has its two sides fighting with each other. So the sooner we can all just get along with each other, the sooner we move forward, the sooner we actually make progress and get this stuff done and try these things.
Yeah, sweet man. All right, James, well, I appreciate your time and your thoughts, and I hope we can catch up again soon.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening. I do hope you enjoyed the show. I am Cody Allingham, and that was the Transformation of Value. If you would like to get in touch, please send me an email at hello@thetransformationofvalue.com, and I will get back to you.